from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, after gas explosions rocked Merrimack Valley last month, Woburn reacts to their own scare.
It's concerning that something like this happened or was on the verge of happening when we just had a very serious incident up in Lawrence.
Also today, does Harvard discriminate against Asian Americans in its admissions process? That's the charge in a trial starting next week. Today, we hear the argument from people who say, yes.
It's so much harder with the equivalent qualifications, and not just GPA or SAT scores, but all told, extracurriculars and community service and all the rest. If you're Asian, it's that much harder to get in.
And MIT's Marsha Bartuszek on astronomy's greatest discoveries and the unsung heroes behind them.
I was very pleased to see that there are so many women who were at the forefront of some of the major ideas in science.
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz, and no, you're not suffering from deja vu. Monday night, a National Grid worker created a potentially dangerous situation in Woburn by allowing gas lines to overpressurize, just like what happened before the gas explosions in Merrimack Valley last month, though that was a different company, Columbia Gas. Fortunately, there were no injuries or property damage this time, but the state is not taking any chances. DPU, that's the Department of Public Utilities, told National Grid to discontinue new gas installations, except in emergency cases, at least until there's a full review of the incident. National Grid held a news conference in Woburn this afternoon. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman was there, and he joins me now. Bruce, good to see you.
You too, Evan.
So, it's been nearly 24 hours since the gas was shut off in Woburn. Tell me about what was said at today's event.
Well, it was a little unusual as these things go. First of all, it was taking place in a parking lot.
Classic parking lot meeting.
Yeah, news conference meeting off Route 93. National Grid had brought in about 200 replacement workers to fix this problem. They surrounded or semi-surrounded an area with huge trucks to block out union workers who were standing on the side. They were afraid they were going to intrude on this news conference. The president of National Grid of Massachusetts was there, and I spoke with her. Her name is Marcy Reed, and she said that National Grid takes full responsibility.
Yeah, we made a mistake, Bruce. We had a technician working routine maintenance in one of our regulator stations, and he made a mistake. The good news is that we have governance structures and controls in place in the event that some of those mistakes are made, because sadly they happen over time, that they're caught.
Yeah, she says that they're not very frequent. In fact, she couldn't remember when the last one was. But National Grid says it's going to reimburse everyone. The company says it's going to be paying people for what their expenses were. They need to present receipts. It's going to start pressurizing these pipes. I guess there are about 3 miles of them in this area. It's going to bring them up to about 2 pounds per square inch slowly, begin testing the lines, and then it's going to start turning on the gas for people beginning tomorrow and ending by Thursday.
So this might not resonate as much. We might not be here talking about it, except for what happened last month in Merrimack Valley, where the pressure inside those Columbia gas pipes was 12 times higher than normal,
right,
which caused explosions. People's homes were destroyed. People are displaced. People are still displaced, right?
Yeah.
An 18-year-old high school student was killed. So this overpressurization, is it something that's happening more and more? Is this a fluke of events, something to fear?
Well, again, Marcy Reed wouldn't say how the overpressurization happened. They've got an investigation that's going to begin once they kind of bring the gas back online. But she did say that overpressurization doesn't happen very often.
I would say it's not normal. Yes, we have had them. I couldn't tell you the last time it was, but they don't happen on a frequent basis by any stretch of the imagination.
I spoke with John Bonapane. He's the president of one of the gas workers unions that's locked out since the end of June. He was on the sidelines, and after the news conference today, he says that he couldn't remember there being an overpressurization problem. He thought maybe back in 2005, but he said, really, I've been around for 30 years doing this. I can't remember one of these happening.
We have jobs that have a lot of responsibility. They're dangerous jobs. And we know that because we've been doing them for a long time. out in the field. And I don't think that National Grid really takes that as serious as they should. It's infuriating to see something like this happen when we know it could have been prevented if we were working.
Yeah, and they want to go back to work. They've been locked out, as I said, since the end of June. They've been talking and negotiating. The negotiations are ongoing. The next negotiation session is this Friday. But, boy, speaking to Bonapane, he does not sound optimistic right now about an outcome there.
Well, getting back to the community affected here, what do Woburn officials have to say? How are they feeling about it?
Well, at the news conference was Mayor Scott Galvin from Woburn. He said he appreciates the prompt and what he called the professional response by National Grid. And he's looking forward to this review of what happened in the accident. And while 30 cities and towns have voted, and this is interesting, 30 cities and towns have voted to prevent National Grid workers from doing new work in their towns. That goes back to the original lockout.
Since the lockout, you mean they voted?
Right. They've actually voted. Now, Woburn did not approve of preventing new work, but they have kind of been observing it. So they're not allowing National Grid workers, replacement workers, to do that. But, you know, Woburn is a blue-collar town. It's a hard-working town. And James Dwyer, I spoke to him. He's a state rep. He actually lives on one of the streets where the gas was shut off. He said he was lucky because he wasn't affected. He has oil. but his daughter, who has got five kids, she lives down the street. She was. And Dwyer says it's time to bring the National Grid lockout workers back.
It's better to have a full force on there for National Grid than it is to have part-time workers or somebody. I'm sure they have experience. But for safety purposes, when's the next problem going to happen?
And Dwyer said this is really alarming, considering what's been going on.
On the heels of what happened in Lawrence, North Andover, and Andover, it's a pretty troubling situation here. You know, it just exacerbates it a little bit for our citizens in the neighborhoods.
So gas should be restored in Woburn around Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And let's get back to the Merrimack Valley explosions problem. What's the current status there? Are they moving forward? How are things going?
Well, they've mobilized a lot of people. They've got 800 workers, something like 200 crews. They're trying to install the pipes, plastic pipes, and replace them with the aging pipes that they've had there. Columbia Gas and the state have been rushing to install this new pipe and turn it on for the over 8,000 customers who are affected. That supposedly their deadline is November 19th. And, you know, Evan, well, National Grid is a public utility. It's overseen by TPU. They had nothing to do with what happened in Lawrence and North Andover and Andover. But, you know, getting back to Woburn, it's overseen by the DPU, as you said in the lead. And last night, the DPU issued a statement. And I've never seen a statement like this. They said they were ordering, quote, National Grid to impose a moratorium on all work, except for emergency and compliance work, across the company's entire service territory, pending the results of DPU's review of National Grid safety practices. That's unprecedented. I've never heard of that.
Unprecedented. It's like just real concern growing at the state level. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's WBUR senior correspondent Bruce Gellerman. Thanks so much, Bruce.
You're welcome, Evan.
I want to turn now to someone who can talk more about how we got ourselves into this situation. Robert Forent, distinguished university professor of history at UMass Lowell. Robert, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Robert, you were listening to the conversation I was just having with Bruce. One thing we kept coming back to is this lockout, right? And just so people understand, a strike is when workers refuse to go to work in the interests of a better bargaining position. A lockout is when the company prevents the workers from coming into work as part of until they can agree to some kind of contract. Is that unusual? Is it common? Is that a major factor? How do you see the lockout and this whole series of events?
Lockouts have become more frequent than they were, say, 10 to 15 years ago in the current economic climate with so much rhetoric in state houses and in Washington against unions. Companies feel more emboldened to use the lockout, which they didn't in the past. And so the idea is usually if a contract ran out, more often than not, workers and the company would say, okay, well, let's just simply continue with the agreement we have in place until we can reach a new agreement. Sometimes the workers would strike or threaten strike as leverage, but increasingly cooler heads would prevail. Obviously not in this particular instance.
And this lockout's been going on for months. And what's interesting about the events in Woburn is they seem like the fulfillment of a kind of risk that workers, locked out workers, have been pointing out all along. That is, gas company locks out workers, replaces them with non-union workers. The union says the replacements lack the necessary skills. And, well, is this evidence that they do, or is this just bad luck? I mean, how do you read this and what's going on in Woburn, what happened in Woburn, as it related to the lockout?
It's, to me, evidence that they're running on, National Grid is running on fumes in terms of trying to get work done by people who may have some sensibility about what they're doing but aren't the highly trained workers that the company has locked out. So having management people or office people who might have some familiarity with the technology and such is not the same as people who would have done the work, as the union spokesperson, the president of the union you had on before, said that you basically are gambling. And the problem with this is it's not making a handful of widgets in a factory where maybe there's some, you know, maybe there's somebody who's a replacement worker who makes a handful of, you know, bad fountain pens or whatever the case may be. In this case, a mistake could be catastrophic. This fortunately was not, but it shows the level, it shows the stakes and the level of possibility.
So do you think that strengthens the union's hand? Do you see, you expect this to be a turning point in negotiations?
I think it should strengthen the union's hand so long as the people like the state representative who you spoke with and others who have some say and can raise the issue and could create some more moral imperative for National Grid to bring its workers back. But otherwise, I mean, it's remarkable to me how quiet people have been. I thought after what happened in Lawrence and Andover and North Andover that the state would move quickly to say to National Grid, before we have something similar, you need to fix this. And so it's also interesting to listen to Marcy Reed from National Grid, because she also said, quoting, I ran down the text from the press conference when I knew I was going to be speaking with you. She also said it was human error. Mistakes happen. This could happen regardless of the workforce we have on the ground. And then she says it's not a rare event to have this happen. But she also said other times that this is really rare. So which is it?
I think it's kind of amazing that you would try to calm people by saying it's not a rare event.
Yeah, it's not a rare event. So, you know, even though we have replacement workers, well, you know, either way, these things happen. Seems to be a weird argument. But at the same time, nobody that you spoke with could remember back as far as, like, the early 2000s hearing of something like this. So, I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, we don't have the skilled workers, but this could have happened anyway. And then, but it never happens. And then, but also, it's not a rare event.
Well, it's got to be one or the other.
Too shaky for me. Yeah. I have gas, so I'm a little concerned.
So, one thing worth emphasizing: like, National Grid is in this weird space where it's preserving, or it's responsible for public safety in a way, monitoring the gas lines. But it's also a private company, right? It's not a public company, so DPU can enforce regulations against it. But it, in some ways, it may be beyond their purview to say, you know what, you need to negotiate with your workers. This is because we have specifically have an arrangement where we've outsourced this to a private company. They get to handle labor relations as a as an independent company. Does that sound right to you? Do you think
it yeah. doesn't? Your description is correct, but it doesn't sound right to me. So you're absolutely right that over the last couple of decades, more and more, these sorts of public, what had been thought of as public utilities, have been privatized. And in the privatization, workforces have been cut. And there's also now shareholders and other investors who want a return on their investments. And so increasingly, where it used to be that the state had more purview over what was going on, it's, you know, it's abstracted many more layers away from local control. I mean, years ago, in fact, some cities even own their water, their gas, and their electric. They were municipal companies that then got sold off because a municipality and or a state, you know, was a way to get revenue without having to raise taxes. But what you're also doing is mortgaging, in a way, control that you have over, you know, these fundamental assets, which are really monopolies. It's not as though somebody that's on the gas line can arbitrarily just find some other solution to their heat and or their electricity. I mean, you could put solar panels in and things like that, but it's not something you can do in the next 24 to 48 hours.
All right. That's what makes it such an interesting space, both from a regulatory perspective and from labor relations, that there's a private company, but they're not operating in an open market, and there are limits to what the state can do. Now, in the meantime, though, right, the DPU has stepped in to say, to put a moratorium on activities, mm-hmm. National Grid activities. That means, you know, business hook, like this is going to affect people in a very clear way, right? Businesses are going to struggle to get gas hookups. People who buy houses may struggle to get gas hookups in the meantime. I don't know how long this is going to last. Can it last for a while? Is this the only leverage the state has over a private company? I mean,
the other lever that they had was regulating a price increase, a rate increase, and saying to them, no rate increase. So you could do that. You could say you could do something like that. I mean, what's fascinating is in labor history, if it was the other way around, so there are numerous occasions in the labor history of the United States where workers would go out on strike and the company would go to the federal government and say, this is a threat to national security, this is a threat to some aspect of our economy, and the federal government would order the workers back to work using very obscure labor laws to say this is a threat to public safety. Or so there was a big coal strike years ago when coal was something that everybody used for heating purposes, and the federal government thought nothing about going to workers who, were out on strike, exercising their legal right to strike, to say, no, you have to go back to work. There have been a number of big steel strikes where the company will say, no, you have to go back to work, and they'll order what's called in labor history a cooling off period. Cooler heads prevail. Figure this out, you guys. We're watching.
So maybe this is where we're headed.
Hearing on that side.
Yeah, maybe this is where we're headed. If things continue to escalate, state interventions requiring workers to go back to work. That's historian Robert Forent, distinguished university professor at UMass Lowell. Thanks so much for joining us, Robert.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Consider this mix of combustible elements: a major elite university, charges of discrimination, and the future of affirmative action. It's all coming to a head next week with the beginning of a trial charging Harvard with discriminating against Asian American applicants. Harvard denies it, saying that they evaluate all candidates in a holistic way and that they're pursuing their established legal right to create a diverse student body. But Students for Fair Admissions, that's the anti-affirmative action group that brought the lawsuit, they disagree, arguing that while Asian Americans have the best academic records, they have the lowest admission rate among any race that apply to Harvard. We're going to speak with folks on both sides, beginning today with Ilya Shapiro. He's a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, and as he wrote in the Wall Street Journal, he thinks, quote, Harvard is too discriminating, end quote, in its admission process. He joins us from St. Louis. How you doing, Ilya?
I'm doing okay.
So
the trial kicks off next week, so this is going to be a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it could turn out to be a big deal. I mean, let's start from the beginning, though, before we get to the big stakes. What exactly does Students for Fair Admissions take issue with in the Harvard admissions process? What is it they're trying to contest?
Well, the Supreme Court over the years has set various standards about how race can be considered in admissions decisions. It has to be one of many factors. It can't be a decisive factor. It can't be an automatic points or quota system, things like that. And then courts, when they're reviewing what colleges do, they don't just defer to the expertise of administrators, but actually drill down to see that race-neutral alternatives were explored, that the use of race is narrow, and things like that. So what the allegations here are that Harvard is using race impermissibly, and especially Asian American applicants are being harmed, because if you take the same level of qualification, including grades, scores, extracurriculars, community service, all the interviews, all that stuff, Asians get in at much lower rates than applicants from other ethnic backgrounds. And if indeed Harvard is doing it that way, then that would seem to violate existing jurisprudence without even opening the door to larger questions about should the Constitution allow race preferences at all.
So just so I'm understanding, it's not that it's impermissible for universities, public and private, to strive for diversity and to take race into account in that way. It's that there are narrow constraints on how they can do it and that Harvard is violating the narrow constraints.
That's right. And the expert brought in by the plaintiffs, by the Students for Fair Admission, has run a regression analysis based on data, some that was already public, some that he got from Harvard during the discovery process and this litigation, showing that there's no explanation that he can, you know, this is why we're having a trial to find out from Harvard, but he can't find an explanation of why admission rates are what they are without taking into account impermissible racial discrimination.
So Harvard, they're defending their quote-unquote whole person evaluation. That is, their approach to applicants that looks at the, you know, the whole person, where race is one of many factors. So here's Harvard President Larry Bacall on Radio Boston in July, some of these factors.
We seek students who come from broad socioeconomic backgrounds because that's part of our mission, is to create opportunity. We seek students who are geographically diverse.
Mm-hmm.
We seek students who are ethnically diverse. Having all sorts of students come together in a learning environment is the function
yeah.
of our admissions process.
Apologies to Larry Bacall, whose name doesn't rhyme with McCaw. But, Ilya, do you think there's value in having diversity in an incoming class?
Depends how you define diversity. I think there's definitely value in having people who want to major in...
Well, let's narrow it and say ethnic and racial diversity. Do you think there's value in having racial and ethnic diversity in an incoming class?
I think there's value in having different backgrounds. I don't think there's value in judging people based on skin color. That's what, for me, it comes down to.
And you acknowledge, though, that the Supreme Court has said that that is a permissible focus of college admissions, or no?
Right. It is. It is as one factor among many, and all of that. What's kind of tricky with what the Supreme Court has said, and this is specifically after the University of Michigan cases 15 years ago, it threw out this mechanical application of points for race, but it allowed and encouraged this kind of holistic review, which is what Harvard actually invented, holistic review, about 100 years ago as a method of potentially capping the number of Jewish admissions. So history is sort of rhyming in a certain sense there. But the problem that the Supreme Court set up is that by allowing this holistic review, the process is a lot less transparent, and some allege, including Students for Fair Admissions, that the racial preferences are even greater than were Harvard to use that kind of mechanical points or quota system that the Supreme Court threw out.
Now, so, I mean, one reason that colleges, there are a couple of reasons colleges, it seems, care about diversity. One is they want to expose incoming students to a variety of people from different backgrounds, and that's connected to the idea that people from different backgrounds bring different perspectives to the way they think, the way they act. There's also a sense that minority students in America have been underrepresented at elite universities for decades. Is that a concern of yours, that limiting universities' ability to consider race in the application process would disproportionately affect minority students who are already shut out of the admissions process in many ways?
Well, it's unclear that even members of racial minorities benefit all that much from preferences that put some people into institutions, into universities that are maybe above where they would otherwise be. And so they begin to achieve at lower levels, and they see that other people who are achieving at lower levels are also members of racial minority groups. And so they feel like there's some sort of structural or institutional, this phenomenon is called mismatch. But the problem that, you know, universities, if they want to engage in affirmative action and go out to high schools that are underrepresented and recruit, that's all fantastic. My problem, and I think this is the nature of the suit, is that you have people that are being admitted apparently solely or as a decisive factor because of the color of their skin. And that's not proper.
Solely, wait, that sounds that sounds too strong, right?
Well, decisive factor, as such a significant factor that it overwhelms other considerations, that as the statistics show, at any given level of qualification, it's that much harder to get in if you're an Asian American applicant than white, than Latino, than black. I mean, this is these sorts of statistics. It's we're not talking about kids who are just a small factor of many, but often it's the deciding factor. It looks like based on
what we see, or at least that's the charge in this particular case. Now, you said earlier that you're not sure racial and ethnic diversity is itself a value universities should pursue or be allowed to pursue. But let's assume then that there's let's say they want to accomplish some kind of diversity, right? And that's been endorsed. If not via race, what are the other ways universities could go about building diverse classes and diverse institutions?
Well, you want to have people of different backgrounds and interests and talents for different sorts of things. You can't have all quarterbacks or all tuba players. You need both. You need mathematicians and history majors alike. And people that have come from different backgrounds, whether they're immigrant families or the first in their family to go to college, whether they, as the president of Harvard said, whether they're from North Dakota or South Beach, Florida. All of that, I think, does make for a vibrant and diverse community. But if you're basically replacing the white privileged kids of doctors and lawyers with black privileged kids of doctors and lawyers, that doesn't seem to me like adding very much diversity.
What if you're not replacing them with black privileged kids of lawyers, but with poorer black or other minority or white kids? What if there was an economic approach? How would you feel about it?
Well, I think different backgrounds is valuable.
But specifically class.
I'm not an admissions officer, but there's what they try to do is identify potential. So if there are high schools that don't offer AP classes, then you can't expect the kid to have AP classes on his transcript, and that's certainly something to take a look at and make sure that you're not overlooking populations that historically have been underrepresented or schools that historically have not sent kids to college, to Harvard. And so that's definitely on the admissions office of these major prestigious national institutions to make more of an effort to identify those diamonds in the rough.
And does the same kind of logic apply to other preferential treatment, say legacies? This gets a lot of attention, right? We know from other documents that students whose parents attended institutions often get a bump in their applications. Is that legitimate, illegitimate? How does that compare to kind of racial preferences in your mind?
Well, I would argue that if there's some super wealthy alumnus donor, that's a little different. If they want to give $100 million, which would give significant scholarship help to hundreds of students or something like that, that's different than simply having been an alumnus. So you could have exceptions like that because it just benefits so many. But the average legacy preference probably should be done away with. And the curiosity here is that legacy preferences were also developed by Harvard as, again, another way of capping Jewish applicants 100 years ago.
Wait, that's really interesting. So you're more sympathetic to super wealthy donor sort of providing a leg up for their overprivileged kids than for just regular legacies. The rationale is just because it does so much more good for the university via the donation?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that I'm more sympathetic for it. I just see, I don't think it's black and white, if you will, but I'm not talking the average donor. You donate $1,000 or something like that annually, but if there's some possibility of significantly changing the nature of campus, building a new library or something on that order. I mean, it's not the average alumnus. That's not the typical legacy preferences that we're talking about. With those, we should definitely just do away with.
How do you see this playing out? Is this a long trial, multi steps up to the Supreme Court for a new major ruling? How do you think this advances?
Well, it's unusual in these affirmative action lawsuits to actually have a trial. Typically, they've just been decided on the papers as a matter of law, and that gets appealed and ultimately goes up to the Supreme Court. Here, we're actually trying to find facts. We could actually learn something in this trial about as Harvard defends itself about how it uses race, what its admissions process is like, that's going to be new. And, you know, I can't predict for you what the opinion of the judge is going to look like, whether ruling for or against Harvard, because there actually are legitimate questions of fact to suss out here. And eventually we'll have a ruling that will be appealed to the First Circuit Court of Appeals and probably will be at the Supreme Court's doorstep in a year and a half or two.
And one reason it seems this might advance is it's not just Harvard, right? Already there have been similar charges at Yale, and you could imagine this spiraling to other elite universities or public universities, no? Similar kinds of concerns.
I think that's right, and that's partially why Harvard was probably the target of this lawsuit as sort of American higher education and the Ivy League, and certainly the Ivies. I'm a graduate of Princeton myself, I should disclose, and I don't take any small glee in the crosshairs, but
it looks like Ilya's phone is cutting out, but this has been an amazing conversation, and I want to thank Ilya Shapiro, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. Tomorrow we'll speak with someone on the other side of this issue, siding with Harvard University. Commercial fishermen in Massachusetts are required to have life jackets on their boats, but they're rarely, if ever, worn. And that's a dangerous practice for the state's lobstermen, for whom falling overboard is a leading cause of death while on the job. Now, a research team is trying to change that outcome by changing the life jackets, not the fishermen. WBUR's Hannah Shinatry brings us this report.
You see anything, Frank?
Steve Holler and Franklin Artis are hauling in a lobster trap. They lean over the edge of the boat and dump its contents into a holding tray. Lenardis hauls the 50-pound trap to the back of the boat, rope trailing behind him.
It's a dance between me and him. Him getting that done, me getting this done. Because of his weight, his strength, he'll knock me right on my rear end. And he's done it a few times.
Over the course of the day, they repeat this dance 300 times. Today, everything goes smoothly. But Holler remembers one day in February when a routine haul went very wrong. A few traps had frozen to the deck.
So I was tugging and tugging and tugging with a hook to try and free them up. And they did free up. And I had lost my balance and I was falling backwards.
The fall launched Holler into the freezing Boston Harbor.
It's an absolute shock. First you're saying, in a split second you're saying, I can't believe this is happening. And then what sets in is like, I've got to get out of the water. But your body has got a whole different idea.
He managed to grab the last rung of a ladder on the dock and pull himself to safety. Holler wasn't wearing a life jacket, and today, out in the middle of the water, he isn't wearing one either. For many lobstermen like Holler, life jackets get in the way of their work.
Never even considered it.
That's Peter Fredrickson. He's been fishing for over 40 years.
Big, bulky life jackets, number one, you can't work in them, and number two, it's hot. And on a day like today, to have anything else besides shorts and a T-shirt and your rain pants is going to be miserable. So no, I hadn't given it a thought.
The most frequent cause of death in the lobster fishing community is falls overboard.
Julie Sorensen is with the Northeast Center for Occupational Health and Safety. A 16-year study from the Centers for Disease Control found that in every fatal fall, the lobsterman was not wearing a life jacket. But Sorensen acknowledges the barriers to use. In addition to the heat, bulk, and high costs, they can run between $80 and $200, some of the styles with buckles can get caught in traps, making the job even more dangerous. So Sorensen determined it's the life jackets that have to change.
I think you need to assume that people are doing the best they can, and that maybe what we need to do as public health researchers is make it easier and more rewarding for them to do the safer thing or the healthier thing.
Sorensen launched a research project aimed at redesigning the life jackets. She and her team recruited 181 lobstermen in Massachusetts and in Maine to wear different types of life jackets for 4 to 6 weeks. Both Peter Fredrickson and his son Josh, who works as Peter Sternman, participated in the study. Josh says they were given versions that clipped around their waists.
If you live through the 90s, it's like a fanny pack, basically.
The small pack has a CO2 cartridge that deploys if you pull the ripcord, inflating the pack. It's a far cry from the old orange horseshoe vests But Peter Fredrickson says it's still not perfect.
The belt loosens up and it falls off. It wasn't easy to clean and you get dirty on a lobster boat, but it worked.
Those issues and other feedback from the study are now with the manufacturers, who will use it to reevaluate the designs. The researchers plan to start phase two next summer, using social media and community events to get more lobstermen interested in the new jackets. They may not win over everyone. Back on his boat, Steve Holler says if there was a design that didn't get in his way, he might consider it. But life jackets just aren't his main concern.
I don't think of it that much. There's more hazards on the boat. I could lose fingers. I could get some serious lacerations with the knives, hand injuries, leg injuries. Falling overboard is on my mind, but it's not at the very top, sadly to say.
But for the Fredricksons, the study changed their minds.
I'm going to wear it all the time now. You know, I'm 65 years old. I get up on the gunwale and my balance isn't what it once was. I feel like this. I've never gone over the side, knock on wood, but I could. So it makes sense.
Peter Fredrickson hopes others will take advantage of the new jackets as well, because lobstermen never think they're going over until the moment they do.
That report from WBUR's Hannah Shinatry. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Say you're about to hail a cab, but let's be imaginative here. It's not just any cab. It's a spaceship cab. Come on. Stay with me. So you get in, and the first thing you need to do is tell the pilot where you're going. And start with the familiar parts, right? ComAv, Boston, Massachusetts, United States. But that's when things get weird. Earth, Milky Way, Virgo supercluster, universe, multiverse. It's the weird cosmic part of the address. That's the part that excites MIT professor and science writer Marcia Bartuszak and helped inspire her new book, Dispatches from Planet 3. Get it? Planet 3? 32 brief tales on the solar system, the Milky Way, and beyond. Marcia, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
To Radio Boston. You've not sat across from me, but I gather you've sat across from other people in this chair.
And I've always enjoyed it.
Well, I hope you enjoy this too. So, it's a book of essays, book of stories, a book about the overlooked and underappreciated souls who made modern science. What made you want to tell these 32 stories?
In my career, I have covered the frontiers of astrophysics, and then over the last decade, I have done some history, dipping into topics like the birth of modern cosmology and the history of black holes. I wanted to put the two together. I wanted to take a new exciting finding and provide the backstory. So all of these essays are taking something new, a new idea, a new discovery, and showing that it had an origin and a seed in the past. I wanted to show people how these discoveries came to be.
Well, it does. You give a sense of the human history. I mean, I've got my favorites, and I'm going to make you talk about my favorites because that's how this works.
All right, there's 32. We can't possibly talk about all 32. But
do you have any that stand out? Was there something you learned along the way that sticks with you?
Well, something that I noticed as I was putting these essays together is giving credit where credit is due. There are a lot of people that have dropped off the radar, one of which is we always give Edwin Hubble credit for discovering the expanding universe.
We've named some things after him.
And yes, the Hubble constant, the Hubble law, a Hubble telescope. But it turns out that there were two other people who were just as important, and their names are not in the history books, not or in the general public. One was a Lowell Observatory astronomer, Vesto Slipher, who actually provided the velocity data that Hubble used in his famous 1929 paper that gave him such a fame. But Hubble did it without giving Slipher credit.
So it's not just like standing on the shoulders of giants, it's not acknowledging that you were standing on the
shoulders. It's pushing them aside and getting all the credit for yourself. I think it should be the Hubble-Slipher constant.
Are you lobbying for that?
Yes, I am campaigning, especially as the 100th anniversary is going to be coming up in the next decade.
Well, let's talk about Chapter 4, where you bring us the story of Percival Lowell. You may recognize that name. Lowell, if you're familiar with Massachusetts history.
Yes.
And how he brought the idea of water on Mars a century ago into the public conversation. Let's start with this character.
Oh, he is. I mean, it's a fascinating story. He is one of the Boston Brahmins. He was independently wealthy. And he graduated from Harvard, went and traveled in Asia, wrote some books. But then he became passionate about astronomy and decided to use his wealth to build his own private observatory.
As one does, in
Flagstaff, Arizona. And he was obsessed with the planet Mars. Just around that time.
This is what time? What?
This was in the 1890s. Okay. Just a decade or so before, there was an Italian astronomer, Giovanni Schiaparelli, who had noticed these streaks on Mars, and he called them in Italian canali, which meant channels. Now, Schiaparelli thought of them as some geologic process, but others jumped onto this name, canali, and said, oh, they are intelligent beings that are building
canals,
waterways.
Like
yes.
Canals are something you build, man-made waterways.
And Percival Lowell became the biggest champion of this idea and used his observatory to expand on this. And he, in the 1890s, used his 24-inch telescope to look at Mars, and he drew these elaborate maps filled with canals, more than 100 waterways. Showing how these intelligent beings were funneling water from the poles and covering the planet and growing vegetation. It was tremendously popular. Now, the professional astronomy community hated this idea. And
well, because it was based on him turning sort of little errors in his telescope into whole channels and a civilization
on a
distant world.
Exactly, exactly. Because the professional community was not seeing the same things. But the public ate it up. In fact, the Wall Street Journal at one point said that his findings were the news story of the year.
I mean, it's a kind of a cautionary tale for popular science writing then and now, presumably.
Yeah, but, you know, there's an irony to this story. Upon his death, of course, this idea went away, especially when the Mars orbiters and the rovers showed that Mars was a totally barren landscape, no life at all. But it did show proof that in the past, like 3 billion years ago, Mars did have flowing water over the landscape. And there are remnants, fossils of those old channels. And I always wonder how Lowell would have felt about that.
The actual discovery of water.
Yes.
So wait, you also, just moving on, right? You've written a whole book about the concept of black holes. And it's also the topic of one of the essays here. And you ask a question which turns out to be pretty bleak, as we'll get to in a second, but it never even occurred to me, and it should have, which is, where does this term black hole come from? It seems so natural and so inevitable, but of course it's not inevitable. Where does it come from?
For decades, people always credited the great Princeton theorist John Wheeler that they said he did it, and he did. He, in a 1967 talk, he used it. He used the term black hole. Before that, they were always called gravitationally collapsed objects. Not
as catchy.
Not as catchy. And he used it in the speech, and it just took off. But it turns out Wheeler was not the first to use it. It actually was used by a Life magazine writer in 1963. He was reporting on an astrophysics conference. A couple weeks later, it was in Science News magazine. Another conference had used the term black hole. And it turns out I traced it to this one physicist, Hung Yi Chu. And I contacted him, and I said, you must have been the one who created the term black hole. In fact, he was the one who created the term quasar. So I thought for sure I had it. And he said no. He said he actually got it a few years before. He had attended a conference in the early 1960s with Robert Dickey, another Princeton theorist, who used the term. He was discussing gravitationally collapsed objects and said, it's like the black hole of Calcutta. And he's the one who put it into the atmosphere, and eventually Wheeler adopted it. But it is Dickey who did it. In fact,
and that Calcutta is the clue also, right? Black Hole of Calcutta.
Calcutta is the infamous 18th century prison where prisoners would go in and they would not come out.
So it's like think of it as being sent to the hole in prison. This
exactly.
is sort of where it comes from. The black hole was this prison space where people went and died, and that name migrated to the stars.
To the stars, yes.
So it's kind of bleak and amazing story that you dug out there. So many of the essays in the collection highlight lesser-known heroes, including a number of female astronomers who just aren't household names like Einstein or Hubble. And I want to ask, before we talk about one of them in particular, is it inspiring to dig up these stories or is it depressing?
I think it's inspiring. And it wasn't my agenda. This is what was interesting, because I did these series of essays over a number of years, and I didn't realize until I put them into a collection that there were all these women, a good quarter of the book. When I go to look at the backstory, there the women are. They just weren't in the spotlight. There was Vera Rubin, who found evidence for dark matter. There was Beatrice Tinsley, who I like to think of as the Darwin of astronomy. She proved that galaxies evolve over time from bright to dimmer. There was Cecilia Payne, who in the 1920s proved that hydrogen was the main element of the universe until she was told to take it out of her thesis.
Well, that's the depressing side of
that's
things.
The
so
depressing
many of these stories
side.
Involve women who made incredible discoveries that were then buried either deliberately or accidentally.
But sometimes there is a correction of the passage. And I feel I'm bringing this to the plate. Just happened a couple weeks ago. Jocelyn Bell Burnell, founder discoverer of the neutron star, did not get the Nobel Prize. Her advisor got the Nobel Prize. But just recently, she got the big breakthrough prize, $3 million. I think that makes up for a little non-credit in the past.
So let's name another of these forgotten women scientists. Henrietta Swan Leavitt. Working in the late 1800s at the Harvard Observatory. Who was she? What did she do there?
She was one of Harvard College Observatory's infamous computers. The director, Edward Pickering, knew that there were all these smart women around with science degrees, and he would hire them to analyze the data that his male astronomers were collecting. As he liked to brag, he could get all these smart women for half the amount of money, half the pay. They got 25 cents an hour. And Henrietta Leavitt was a specialist in variable stars. That's what her task was, to look out for variable stars. And she found more than 2,000 over her lifetime.
These are stars whose brightness varies.
They vary. These
time.
Are stars at a certain stage in their life. They're breathing in and out, and they get brighter and dimmer, brighter and dimmer. And she found a specific pattern that enabled astronomers to use it as a standard candle, a cosmological yardstick, to measure distances far more distant than they'd ever been able to do
again,
before.
Because, again, this is a question to think about. But like, how do we know how far away some of these stars are? This was a key moment
this
in figuring
that
out. This
was an absolute key moment. In fact, her discovery allowed Harlow Shapley to show the real size of the Milky Way, and also that we're kicked off to the side. And Edwin Hubble could not have discovered that there were other galaxies beyond the Milky Way without Leavitt's law. And so she is terribly important. In fact, she was nominated for a Nobel Prize for this achievement. But unfortunately,
after she died,
the person did not know that she had died, and so she could not get such an award.
It was a touching moment in your book. Can I ask you quickly, if there's something on the frontier of science that you are most looking forward to at the moment, somewhere you keep your eyes in the sort of cosmological research or the physics research?
I am wanting to find the dark matter. I have first reported on that. I was one of the first to write on this in the early 1980s. At that time, it was known as the missing mass, now known as
the
dark.
This is the stuff that seems to be pushing galaxies apart.
Well, that's the dark energy.
Oh, thank you.
Dark matter is there's this extra invisible material. They know, they see it gravitationally. They they know that the galaxies are surrounded by this extra material. It cannot be ordinary matter, but they think it's something mysterious. I want to know what it is.
Well, I want to have you on when they figure it out so you can explain it to me. That's Marcia Bartuszak. She's a science writer and professor at MIT. Her new book is Dispatches from Planet 3, 32 Brief Tales on the Solar System, the Milky Way, and Beyond. She'll be at Harvard Bookstore event on Wednesday, October 17th. Thank you, Marcia. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.